Hey, welcome along. This is Mark Stein. It is 4 p.m. Eastern Time in North America. That means it's 5:30 p.m. in Newfoundland, where they like to live life on the half hour. 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time, 10 p.m. in Rome, 11 p.m. Cairo, midnight in Moscow, and 2:30 a.m. in Delhi for any Newfoundlanders minded to move to India to enjoy all that half-hour time zone in a sultrier climate. And whatever it is, it's Wednesday morning, some fairly ungodly hour in Oz and slightly more civilized hour in New Zealand. And wherever you are, welcome along to our Clubland Q&A live around the planet. This is where I take your questions live. All you got to do is go and shoot me a question at the relevant page at steinonline.com. You have to be a member of the Mark Stein Club, but if you sign up and join the club now, we might get to your question before the end of the show. So we did that a few weeks ago, actually, for a lady who signed up 2 minutes before the show started, and boom, express check-in. She had her question on air just a few minutes later. Emily Maximov writes, with plans for the DC gun march underway, this is actually an anti-gun march, I find it odd when certain events spark activism and others don't. I'm by no means a gun enthusiast, but find it surprising that even those on the left want to give more power to an obviously inept government. Nicholas Cruz, as you mentioned, was a known wolf to local law enforcement and even the FBI, which means this massacre could have been prevented. Kate Steinle's murderer was a seven-time felon given special privileges that allowed him to stay in the country and in turn kill an innocent person. Where was the public outcry when Kate was murdered? Why would anyone attend a march to give more control to officials that let these types of crimes occur? Well, Emily makes a very good point. Whatever else you may think of about the events in Florida, it was an appalling failure of government, just as 9/11 was. And what's interesting to me is that when you screw up in government, in American government particularly, I regret to say, you never pay a price for it. All those big fancy pants, money, no object acronyms that failed America on 9/11, including institutions like the FAA, I think I mentioned here a few weeks ago, when somebody called up about whatever it was, the third plane hijacking, and wanted to know what to do. And the lady on the phone, these are in the transcripts, the official transcripts, said, I don't know, everybody's just left the room. They basically abandoned their posts the one time the FAA were needed. Nobody resigned. Nobody ever takes responsibility, to use a quaint phrase. And it's exactly the same thing in Florida. And I love the way that, again, I think this is peculiar with respect to a certain kind of American bureaucracy. The need to obscure what is going on with a kind of linguistic inflationary flimflam. I thought the performance of the sheriff and the local FBI guy in Florida a couple of days ago, I think this was this Friday or Monday, it was absolutely appalling when the FBI guy comes out and he says that the relevant protocol was not followed. By this he means that although someone tipped off the FBI that this named individual was behaving in a particular way, this person, this individual who reported Nicholas Cruz, believed that Cruz was going to pull off a school shooting and it would likely be his old school, this particular high school in Parkland. The FBI, as this weaselly agent said in the press conference, didn't follow the protocol. By protocol, they mean that you call 1-800-FBI and say, I think Nicholas Cruz is going to do something. And 1-800-FBI, whoever's at the call center, is supposed to pass that on to the Miami office. That's what would happen if you called, the call center at Microsoft or Apple or whatever. All their call centers are all in India, but the guys working for, you know, nothing per hour in the Bangalore call center know to pass it on to the relevant person. And they don't need to call it something screwy like a protocol either. What that means is you discovering that you missed your grandmother's funeral because the lady who answers the telephone in your office failed to follow the protocol. It's not a protocol. Don't make it sound more stupid than it is. Somebody didn't pass on the message. Somebody called 1-800-FBI with very specific information, and it wasn't followed. And likewise, the sheriff with the 20 calls into his local police department about this guy failed to follow his protocol too. This language, weaselly language, is designed to evade the bone-crushing stupidity of what happened and prevent people from taking responsibility for it. And one of the things I think we've learned, or we should have learned after 9/11, is really when bad things happen, government and government bureaucracy isn't there with you. In a sense, and I don't want to overdo this comparison, but in a sense, the modern jet airliner and the modern American schoolhouse are the most government-controlled environments on the planet. On an airliner, you can't make a move without following FAA regulations. You know, if you're sitting there on the tarmac for 3 hours waiting for the bloody thing to take off and you want a Diet Coke, it's a big deal to get them to open up the beverage cart while they're still sitting there on the tarmac, stacked up due to air traffic control for 3 hours. It was the most controlled, and on September 11th, it was the most controlled environment in American life. And in the end, when something bad happened, the government wasn't there for you. And likewise with what happened in that Florida school, where there was an armed guard, which I think is sad and pitiful to have in a modern schoolhouse. And he was a long way away and wasn't anywhere near what was happening. And in fact, the kid knew more about the movements of the security guard than the security guard knew about the movements of the shooter. When this desire to mortgage your security 100% to the government is bizarre, given government failure. And Emily says, quote, "I'm by no means a gun enthusiast." You don't particularly have to be. I think this argument is ridiculous. We're not starting from a position where there's population A with no guns and population B with no guns, and we're discussing something hypothetical. Even if you were to ban all guns tomorrow morning at 10 a.m., there's over 300 million guns in the private possession of American citizens. How are you going to get all of those? There's not going to be a confiscation of 300 million guns. So realistically, all this gun talk, I don't think, is going anywhere. And I don't even actually think it's a constitutional issue. I think it's actually more basic than that. Americans talk a lot about American exceptionalism, and that can sometimes seem odd to those of us from other parts of the world, because it seems perfectly obvious that certain ideas that Americans run with are in fact ideas of other places that they just, you know, tweaked a little or took in another direction. But the idea of gun ownership is actually part of American exceptionalism, that I think the idea of being allowed to own guns, not just for hunting or for a shooting club or whatever, but actually just being able to drive around with a gun in your glove box, is part of what it means to be American. And I think a lot of Americans think like that, and they don't want to stop thinking like that. And so that's just not going to go anywhere. And in fact, actually, I think as you look at other West, and that's not true to the same, it wasn't true of Australians in 1996. It wasn't true of Canadians after the Montreal massacre. Rural Canadians, I believe, own long guns at a much higher rate than Americans, but they weren't invested in handguns emotionally and as a sense of what it means to be Canadian or Australian in 1996 or in the UK after Dunblane, the Dunblane massacre around the same time. And I would have thought, and I will make a general observation here, it seems to me that to go back to the failures of bureaucracy, government can't protect you from a lot of the things that are happening in the modern world. If you happen to be going out for dinner on a Saturday night to a restaurant in London or Paris or Berlin or Stockholm, and some crazy guy goes Allahu Akbar and decides to ride up on to the sidewalk and come at you and kill you, I don't think government can do a lot to protect you from that. And so I think the idea of people being having to make provision for their own protection is going to increase in the years ahead. And that being so, I would think that in other Western nations, who more or less in the course of the 20th century detached themselves from the idea of individual self-protection in a way that Americans did not, I would think that sense of assuming the necessity of being able to defend yourself will reassert itself in, say, Europeans or Australians, rather than Americans deciding the alternative, which is that they no longer need guns or they don't want guns and they're happy to leave things to the incompetent bureaucracy, which, as with the Boston Marathon guys, as with the panty bomber over Detroit, and as with this fella down in Florida, the big-time, money-no-object, lavishly endowed bureaucracy flopped out big time. So I don't, in that sense, think the gun debate is going to be going anywhere terribly interesting. Roy Blair writes, the latest impasse in Northern Ireland politics has been brought by the insistence by Sinn Féin on having the Irish language being given equal status with English. Irish is spoken by 0.02% of the population, and there are none of those who don't speak English. Apart from the huge financial cost to the taxpayer, this would have the effect of providing an enormous job creation scheme for the nationalist population. Irish is only taught in Catholic schools. Despite this, the usual pink and liberal voices are doing what they always do and laying the blame on the intransigence of the bigoted loyalists. The less extreme ones blame both sides. Your comments, please. Well, this is very interesting, and Roy is quite right. I like a little bit of Irish every now and again. I like to say Taoiseach instead of Prime Minister, and I like to talk about a hung Doyle rather than a hung Parliament. I like a wee little bitsy bit of Irish. I like to see telephone or whatever, however you pronounce it, on the public telephone boxes. But the rest of it is nonsense, and it's a make-work thing. But, and incidentally, if we were all going back to 1922 and starting all over, I would have recommended to Mr. De Valera that he get serious and actually make Ireland a unilingual Irish speaking state, and that would have been actually if he'd had the courage of his convictions, he would have done that. But you're right, Roy, that this is a make work scheme, and it's a rather cunning one, because if you have essentially create an entirely artificial Irish language bureaucracy for which there is no need, no public desire, what it does do is it incentivizes the creation of a government class apart from the people. That's what happened when the Liberals decided to give French and English equal status in Canada. There are very few actual living bilingual people in Canada, for the very good reason that most people are naturally unilingual in Canada, because there's English Canada, there's French Canada, And there's a couple of places like Montreal that where people happen to speak English and French within close proximity to each other. But actually, that's extremely unusual. And most people live in unilingual English Canada or unilingual French Canada. So if you make bilingualism mandatory, what you do, in effect, is incentivize the creation of a government class apart from the people, where you have to be bilingual to work in the federal bureaucracy and rise above a certain level. You basically exclude the majority of people from participation in government. And Sinn Féin, you can say a lot of things about Sinn Féin, but then and they can be murderous and violent and all the rest of it, but they're not actually stupid. And they wouldn't be doing this if they didn't understand that the creation of an Irish language bureaucracy in Ulster will benefit them to the exclusion of the vast majority of the population of Northern Ireland. I say nuts to it. I'm in favour of languages surviving on their own terms. Rich writes, "Hi, Mark. Love being part of the club." Well, we love having you as part of the club, Rudge. Rudge. Sorry, I didn't mean to call you Rudge. Do your friends call you Rudge? I don't know. Anyway, we're glad to have you part of the club, Rich. And you write, "With regard to the key differences between the American Republic and Her Majesty's Dominions, I'm moving from traditional pistols to love guns." Whoa. "Bermudan courts legalized gay marriage just last year, but repealed the law over the weekend. Theresa May has said she's disappointed, but will not attempt to reverse the decision. Do you think this could be a cultural bellwether for the rest of the world, or will the Waffen SSM crack some skulls until the locals say uncle?" Well, we're already seeing calls for a big gay boycott of Bermuda. If you know anything about Bermuda or heading south, the West Indies, you'll know that they're not big on open displays of homosexuality. And in fact, Bermuda, which actually has quite a conservative bent just in public display anyway, they don't like you walking around bare-chested or whatever in the streets. So they actually enforce quite a rigorous dress code there. Until this court decision last year, homosexuals visiting Bermuda were enjoined not to engage in open displays of affection. So if you and your hot stud are on the beach in Bermuda, if you're on the beach, if you're staying at the Southampton Princess or the Hamilton Princess, don't go canoodling around the pool. That's what they say. They don't like it. And they never have liked it. And one can argue about that. There's a piece in my book, The Undocumented Mark Stein, about how a Guardian female columnist blamed the undoubted Bermudan and Caribbean homophobia on the fact that black men were taken as slaves from Africa to be the playthings of self-loathing homosexual English slaveholders. I missed that chapter in my history book. And in fact, in the West Indies, most of the plantation landlords were absentee landlords, but apparently, according to The Guardian, they were absentee sodomites as well. Even though they were back in England, they were endowing the black populations of the British West Indies with all their own complex repressed feelings about homosexuality. And I have some sport with that in my book. But one of the results of that is that none of these countries, whether they're sovereign nations or colonies like Bermuda, are at all keen on homosexuality. And Rich actually makes an interesting point here, because Bermuda has done something that I think California attempted to do, and then that got struck down by a California judge, and they passed they legalized gay marriage and then they delegalized it. So it was legal for a year, and then it moved back, and it's now moved back into the illegal camp. And Theresa May has said she's not going to attempt to reverse the decision, which I think would be a bit tricky. I mean, it's generally accepted now that colonies, most British colonies, are self-governing in internal matters, and that Westminster only weighs in with relation to defence and foreign affairs. So, for example, when Obama dropped the four Uyghurs that he sprang from Gitmo on Bermuda, he should not have done that, and the Bermudan government should not have accepted it. That's something that Washington should have discussed with London. But Obama wanted to flip the finger to London, so he didn't care about that. That actually was London's business, whereas the policy on gay marriage within Bermuda is something that I think most courts would regard as something as a matter for Bermudans. And it's interesting, in a sense, you reach the same destination by different routes. And we are, and again, this comes back to what I was saying about American exceptionalism. You know, for all the exceptionalism, the United States is heading in the same direction as many other places, just getting there by a slightly different route. But you couldn't honestly say, as I've often pointed out, a lot of bad Canadian ideas come south of the border, and not too many great American ideas go north of the border. So we'll see. Mark de Biasi writes, I hope I pronounced that right. Mark says, Mark, I've been scratching my head trying to understand the bedrock principles of the left, and the only things I can come up with so far are, one, we're smarter than everyone else, and two, the end justifies the means. What are your thoughts? And I think that's right. I think actually, this is one of the problems of identity politics and virtue signaling. So that the point of policies, you know, on the right, people talk about policy from a sort of a philosophical small government point of view, and on the left they talk about it differently. But the left has no real interest in the utilitarian aspect of policy making. In other words, what practical impact it has. It doesn't matter if it destroys families, it doesn't matter if it wreaks havoc, as long as it makes you feel good about yourself. And so obviously, if the purpose of a policy is to make you feel good about yourself and to advertise your moral superiority, then by definition, that means you are better than your opponents. And if you are better than your opponents, it becomes then natural to assume that your opponents deserve to lose. It's not as if you're engaged in honest combat. It's not as if you're playing a game of rugby and Team A is up against Team B and Team B has a couple of injuries so isn't quite on its game that day. No. You are morally superior to your opponents, and so your opponents deserve to lose. And if by some misfortune they don't lose, then you are morally enjoined to use other aspects of power, such as the courts and the bureaucracy, to tie them up in knots and prevent them using their victory, because, as you have already established, you do not just favour a different set of policies. You are actually a better person. You are a morally superior person to your opponent, and thus they have no right to govern. And it becomes very difficult once you do that to have actually the normal swings and roundabouts of competitive politics and multi-party states, which is why we've seen the left, I think, go bananas. I mean, I talked about this on Tucker, and I think it's actually extremely... I mean, David Gergen is not someone I've any use for, and it slightly amazes me that that chap can make a living in American television, but apparently he can. David Gergen, when he bemoans the authoritarian streak in Trump and that Trump is weakening American democracy. And as I pointed out on Tucker, What weakens American democracy in the sense of multi-party competitiveness is when the ruling party loses power and will not accept the result, as those dozens and dozens of Democrats who refused to attend the inauguration demonstrated on January 20th. Trump hadn't set foot in his office. He hadn't done a thing. He wasn't president yet, and they'd already decided he was illegitimate. When you strike at the very heart of a free society when you do that, because you're not accepting the peaceful transition of power. Glenn Flint writes, Mark Stein Show guest F.H. Buckley opines that the Westminster Constitution used by Canada is superior to the U.S. Constitution. I'd be interested in hearing more about this. Both systems are nibbling away at their citizens' rights. You've had your share of troubles with the Canadian Human Rights Commission as well as the sclerotic US court system. The Bill of Rights is under attack in academia and the media. Where does it all end? Would you moderate a debate between Mark Levin, a constitutional conservative... Sorry, I think I got a copy of the US Constitution stuck in my throat there. Between Mark Levin, a constitutional conservative, and F.H. Buckley to explore this topic further. You should take that one up with Mark Levin, Glenn. Has the administrative state effectively nullified the US Constitution as President Wilson and the progressive cabal dreamed over 100 years ago? What's the best way to bind the government with the chains of either constitution and restore our liberty? Well, you know, I always say the difference between the American Constitution and the British North America Act of 1867, which is Canada's constitution, is that you guys wrote it all down. And our guys didn't. Our guys just say in whatever it is, Article 17, executive power shall be vested in Her Majesty. And everybody knows there's a little bit more to it than that, but it's not spelled out. The Canadian Constitution, the Australian Constitution don't mention the Prime Minister or the Cabinet or anything like that. Nevertheless, the British North America Act must have something going for it because it's been applied to, I think it's over 50 countries now, you know, to Belize and to Tuvalu. And we were talking about Bermuda a few moments ago. Essentially, Bermuda operates under a version of the British North America Act. People wouldn't be taking it up if it wasn't in some sense functional. Whereas, unlike that Article 18, executive power shall be vested in Her Majesty, the US Constitution spells it all out. And if you look at it as a practical matter, that the problem here is that free societies depend on the virtue of their citizens and the virtue of their governing classes. In a sense, they're designed for gentlemen. And if you don't have gentlemen, you can ride a coach and horses through a constitution. You can ride a coach and horses through a Westminster-style constitution by declining to accept the conventions, because none of it's written down. You can ride a coach and horses through the US Constitution in the way that so many American judges do, which is by torturing the language so that you're turning it into some kind of linguistic pretzel to justify whatever it is that you actually want to do. I mean, for example, to go back to gay marriage, whatever you feel about gay marriage, the founders would have thought it was complete nonsense and would have thought it was no more relevant to anything they'd put in a constitution they would no more think about, you know, saying marriage is between a man and a woman than they would think of saying that, you know, water flows downhill. It was part of the natural order of things. So to attempt to divine in their mouldering bit of parchment a right to same-sex marriage is in a certain sense a nonsense. It's a nonsense. It's something new. It's a novelty. And you should at least have the honesty to recognize that it's a novelty and that therefore it is something novel, that it is of the hour, of the moment, that the legislators of the hour and of the moment should be making provision for. But as I said, I think the real problem here is that whether you have an actual republic, like America was certainly 200 years ago, when Tocqueville was travelling through it, or whether you have what I think it was Montesquieu called a crowned republic, which is in essence what England has been for many centuries, and to a certain extent is what England exported around the world, where it's the exact opposite of absolute monarchy. Just to be constitutional about it, what that phrase in the British North America Act or any other British Commonwealth Constitution means is that you are vesting, executive power shall be vested in Her Majesty, means that you're actually vesting all power in a vast repository of no power. It's a paradox, and it's an important paradox in that sense, and it's very important to understand it as such. I mean, it's actually a little more than what Montesquieu meant by a crowned republic. And I think that's why it proved more resilient than, say, the French and German and Italian constitutions in the turbulent years of the 20th century. That there is actually something very profound about the way it vests power in the absence of power. That is a very subtle and artful trick. I don't think it's given enough credit. But the point is that all these systems, both these systems, are sophisticated systems that, in a sense, depend on a virtuous populace. And if you have, what we have now, where you have a huge dependency class, a huge permanent bureaucracy, you wind up without virtue. Without virtue. Sue Sims writes, since the Florida shooting, the commentariat seems to have divided along party lines, so to speak, with the left calling for gun control and the right attacking the FBI for failing to do anything about the shooter, even though they'd been warned. The problems with gun control are obvious, ranging from the Second Amendment to the impracticality of confiscating hundreds of millions of guns. But isn't there also a problem on the other side? Is it possible that the FBI have so many reports of this nature that it's impossible to act on all of them? I know that here in the UK, MI5 have so many suspected terrorists to deal with that they can't possibly check and supervise more than a fraction. I'm not making excuses, just wondering. MI5, I think, have a real problem in that they're trying to monitor suspected jihadists. And I think they say they have 23,000 of them. For purposes of comparison, we were talking about Sinn Féin at the top of the show. At the height of the Irish Troubles, MI5 estimated that there were no more, at any one time, there were no more than 100 active members of the IRA. So that's all the security service had to monitor, 100 people. Now, according to them, they have to monitor 23,000 people. And to do that round the clock takes dozens of people. And you can understand it's if you do that, everything else goes by the way, and it's very difficult to do. It's unaffordable. You're going to go broke. If you've got as many as Germany you'll go broke. But I don't think that's what happened here, Sue. As I said, all that happened, we're in danger of overcomplicating this because the FBI guy and, to a certain extent, a lesser extent, but still an extent, the sheriff in Florida last week were not honest about the screw-up. The FBI guy, when he said that the protocol wasn't followed, means that somebody gets a specific information at a call center and it wasn't passed on. That's all. The call centers in West Virginia, you call 1-800 whatever it is, it rings out in West Virginia and somebody answers the phone in West Virginia. And they're supposed to route the information they're given to the relevant field office. It was not passed on to the Miami field office. And we can disguise that, but in the end, that belongs to Jimmy or Darlene or Peggy Sue or whoever it is who picked up the phone, took that call, and did not pass. That's all it is. That's all it is. It's not a protocol. It's nothing any more complicated than somebody just not passing that information on. Then it would have required somebody in the FBI field office to actually pass it on to this sheriff, to the local guy. That's a whole other thing. You know, one of the things, you say that you're in the UK, Sue. I don't know where you are in the UK, but if you're in Gloucestershire and something happens, you call the Gloucestershire police. There's just the police, quote, the police, unquote. In the United States, there's these competing levels of law enforcement. I mean, it's not just local, county, state, and federal, but there's also competing agencies within the federal level. And of course, there's, you know, that's before you get into specialized police agencies for fish and wildlife and all the rest of it. And it's no secret that a big part of the problem is not just that federal level doesn't necessarily pass it on to local level. It's also that within the federal bureaucracy, everyone hoards information and keeps it to themselves. When you look at the stuff they do have time to do, however, and this is where Trump, no one seriously believes that. They failed to stop the Florida guy because they're tormenting Michael Flynn with some phony baloney lying to the FBI charge. No one seriously believes that. But Trump is right to tweet it because you can tell a lot about a bureaucracy by the things they prioritize. I have no real idea why the FBI's mission has metastasized so that, for example, even if it is the case that the Russian government is doing something in US elections that you can try to prevent them doing, why that should be the job of a federal law enforcement agency such as the FBI. On the other hand, I do think the FBI, and I'm not even sure on the other hand, that if you're someone who thinks a guy is going to shoot up your school, that you should necessarily go to the FBI over it rather than the local police department. And again, I think this way is where this whole money near no object, multiple bureaucracies. Everyone keeps saying with the Russia investigation, well, 17 intelligence agencies have decided that the Russians did interfere in the election, as if that's something to be impressed by. What kind of cockamamie government has 17 different intelligence agencies? This doesn't help. It's the 48-car motorcade applied to everything, so that there's a, you know, when you call 1-800-FBI to report some crazy guy is going to shoot up your school, that too gets lost in a kind of 48-car motorcade of bureaucratic obfuscation. None of this helps. Lean, mean government is the way to get effective government. Big, bloated government is the way to ensure there are just more and more cracks for people to fall through. Holly writes, Mark, there is a candidate for governor of Minnesota, of all places, Philip Parrish, who is attempting to expose the religious liberty shibboleth used by Muslims. He says he separates Islam from the word faith because faith takes belief and Islam requires only submission. Before He will meet with Muslim groups. He requires that they publicly denounce Sharia law and declare that, quote, Islam, Sharia, and the Quran are the antithesis of the US Constitution. Your thoughts, please. Thank you for that, Holly. By the way, you spelt Quran, Q-U-R-A-N, so you get two demerits for that. But on the other hand, at least didn't put any of those stupid apostrophes in the middle of it, like people like to do these days. Quran is K-O-R-A-N. That was spelt how it was spelt in the English language for years, until it was felt that we should try and make it look more exotic than it is. Your gubernatorial candidate, Mr. Parrish, is absolutely right. Islam is a political project. It's an imperialist project. It's actually a supremacist project. And the fact is that whether or not it's the precise, I mean, this gets back to what we were talking about earlier, whether it's the precise antithesis of the US Constitution, Sharia is incompatible. With the United States Constitution. If you have Sharia, you do not have a free society. And the retained affection for Sharia among self-segregating Muslim communities in Europe and Australia and also in North America will eventually become consequential. It's consequential already in the sense that if you get to the stage that France is at, where you're looking in a very short time at maybe a 20% Muslim population, to have even the barest majority of the remaining 80% in to have barely the barest majority in favor of free speech, you're going to have something like 75% of the remaining population gung-ho for free speech. And so that's where the Charlie Hebdo guys, for example, knew where they were headed on this, that you weren't going to have free speech if you have 20% of people who are Muslim, because there's simply, well, nobody's talking about unpleasant people. Nobody's talking about people who bomb things. Nobody's talking about people who are going to drive up on the sidewalk or hijack airliners. We're just saying that there is simply no culture of vigorous debate and free inquiry. And in that case, the core Western liberties that undergird the United States Constitution will not be defended. And so Mr. Parrish is right. Islam is different. And these twerp, here we are, coming up to 17 years after 9/11, and twerp progressives who advertise their multiculti bona fides by thinking that a mosque opening up on Main Street is no different from a congregational church with a nice lesbian pastor opening up on Main Street, fail to understand the totalitarian nature of Islam. That there is no distinguishing between what you render to God and what you render to Caesar. God and Caesar are all part of the same package, the same unitary package, and the same controlling legal authority responsible for both. And it's not wrong to point that out, and we need more people running for governor and running for senator and running for congressman pointing that out. Robert Stewart writes, Mark, watching any number of governmental management processes, I have concluded that the bureaucrats have almost no interest in actually solving the problem that led to the formation of their agency. In fact, the more controversial the discussion of the problems becomes, the greater the opportunity for politicians to promise utopian solutions, which always involve increasing the government's role. And the bureaucrats are more than willing to provide ammunition for the fearmongers. This really argues for divesting as much as possible from the government. This is a form of positive feedback which always ends badly. Yes, it's the old Mrs. Thatcher's old line that you should never create a bureaucracy to address a problem, because once you do that, you will never be rid of the problem, because it is in the nature of a government bureaucracy to manage the problem in perpetuity, in the course of which the problem will just get worse, such as, you know, the war on poverty, for example, to take one government program, and actually a lot of some of these more specialized law enforcement activities like the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco and Firearms and that sort of thing too. Or even at the international level, the Palestinians are the only people to enjoy a UN bureaucracy that exists purely for the management of Palestinian refugees. And therefore, even though these refugees were created in 1948, there is still a vast international bureaucracy now managing the great-great-grandchildren of those refugees. That's actually a microcosm of what happens when you create a purpose-built bureaucracy to address any a particular problem. Laura Rosen-Cohen writes, could you share your thoughts about the chatter that PM Hairdo, I believe that's a reference to Mr. Justin Trudeau, and the imbecilic Liberal government is planning to resurrect the execrable Section 13 of the pathetically and Orwellian named Canadian Human Rights Act. Well, this was, there are no permanent victories in politics, alas, and I see that. Because I'm proud to say I played a small role in ridding Canada of Section 13. I occasionally crow to this about this when I'm stopped by border guards at the Canadian border, and I always caution them that the last time the government of Canada picked a fight with me, they wound up repealing the law. And there's like we exchange glowering glances for a bit, and then they let me drive on. And it is disgusting that this law, which was repealed only 5 years ago or whatever it was, that the Liberals are now thinking of bringing back. It goes back to what Robert Stewart was saying, Laura, that government thinks of its role increasingly as to mediate between competing groups in society. This is, again, why, whether you have a Westminster Constitution or the US Constitution, identity politics is a cancer to both of them. Because what it says is that what matters is not that you are an individual before the law, whether you are a citizen of a republic or a subject of the crown. It says what matters is that you are a member of a particular identity group. And that because a lot of there are contradictions and conflicts between these identity groups, you require a powerful government to mediate the frictions between identity groups. So in this case, the argument being made by Justin and other people of his ilk is that the government needs Section 13 because they have so bollocksed up the populations of Western nations that there are now all kinds of fragmenting, competing, balkanized groups who actually should probably not be living in close proximity to each other. Pity the nice gay couple who live at 14 Elm Street when the big bearded imam and his child brides move in at 16 Elm Street. In the multicultural utopia, if you're Justin, you can wear your Ramadan socks to the gay pride parade. But actually, if you're the gay guy at 14 Elm Street and you wear your gay socks to the Ramadan parade, the far-breathing imam is not going to like that. And so because of these frictions, which are likely to increase in the years ahead, the solution of Justin Trudeau is that the best way to manage that is by not letting people speak honestly about it. Whether you're the gay guy who doesn't like the fire-breathing imam, or you're the fire-breathing imam who thinks the godless sodomites are going to be roasting in hell, the idea of Justin Trudeau is that you need a big government to mediate harmony between all these groups. And there will be less and less honest conversation. That in effect, he will be just as you roll down a condom for safe sex to prevent contaminating body fluids getting from one party to another party. So in the nation at large, we will, instead of a giant condom, we will roll down a giant Justin Trudeau Ramadan sock over public discourse to prevent any kind of lively outburst from one party infecting another party. It is nonsense. It is insulting to formerly free peoples. And it is going ultimately to destroy Western societies. Let's see. Oh, Neil has a... Neil says, my question is, where did multiculturalism and its evil twin sister, political correctness, come from, and how did it gain so much power? Wikipedia said it comes from Canada. Somebody else says it arrived in Sweden thanks to a Polish-born Jew. I don't think there actually is a patient zero for multiculturalism. My view of this is that the West's intellectual class never recovered from the horrors of the Great War, from trench warfare, and the slaughter of the war to end all wars 100 years ago. And the Western world had had a pretty good time since the revolutions of 1848, all the way up to the shooting of the Archduke in 1914. It had had a pretty incredible two-thirds of a century of enormous technological progress, enormous advance in the freedoms, individual freedom, enormous advance in personal prosperity, economic opportunity, health, technology, arts, almost any measure you care to mention. And it had done this largely without government. In H.A.P. Taylor's famous line that in whatever it was, I think before the First World War, 1914, the English and the average Englishman had virtually no intercourse with government except for occasional encounters with his village policeman and his postmistress. And what happened in the First World War is, I think, the huge death toll in that actually hollowed out the intellectual class's belief in the moral superiority of their own civilization. And it actually corroded their faith in the civilization. And so we're going back now to the 1920s and 1930s, and we're talking about four or five generations of intellectuals who do not believe in Western civilization. Now, there's a difference, of course. The guys in the 20s and 30s knew something about it. The guys now at most American and Canadian and European campuses know nothing about nothing. So they don't even know what they hate. But like most kinds of hatred, self-hatred is by far the most poisonous and the most destructive. So Neil asks, why would one culture want to weaken itself with obvious drivel? Why would a country actively pursue multiple languages and multiple cultures? Cannot those cultures grow in their own garden without being encouraged to take over Western cultures like an invasive weed? It makes no sense to me. What's the purpose? Please help me to understand this great mystery of life. Well, it's not a mystery. It's not a mystery, because as insane as it is, the world was built, the modern world, insofar as it functions, was built by the forces from a relatively narrow sliver of that world. And it's maybe a bit insensitive to say that, it's maybe a bit mean to point that out, but it happens to be the truth. And I'm not necessarily making any moral claims to it, and I'm not necessarily making any claims for any particular part of the Western tradition. You can say that the Dutch invented capitalism, for example, but they're not what one would call big colonizers or whatever. Other people took up their ideas. I mean, we are the beneficiaries of a great coursing current from Greece through Rome to Jerusalem to Europe. As a result of that, we have a world in which people can live longer, more fulfilling lives of greater economic opportunity, of greater personal happiness than at any time in human history. And yet we teach ourselves that we are the problem and we are so evil that, in fact, the moral stain on us cannot be extinguished until we are extinguished. And that's not an exaggeration. You know, we have seen, I mentioned, I think it was in a recent Stein post, I was talking about this fella who, these guys who went in and harassed everybody in this Churchillian restaurant in London, and they said that Churchill was a Nazi. That's what we're dealing with now. Churchill, the guy who stood alone against the Nazis, or who persuaded Britain and the Empire to continue standing alone after the fall of France for 18 months, the hinge moment of the 20th century, the one that determined, in fact, that the Nazis would not inherit the second half of the 20th century, the guy who stood alone against the Nazis is now the Nazi. Just as Britain are the great pro-slavery guys, even though William Wilberforce and the Royal Navy are the people who rid the planet of slavery. There is no... A self-loather loathes with an intensity unknown to those who just have hatreds of strange, distant other people. And we are now at the stage where there is virtually nothing we will not pervert and hollow out and strip of all meaning until there is nothing left. And we saw it last year in that ghastly, horrible, shameful 150th anniversary of Canada. Canada, you know, if you're in America, all the time people saying, oh, why can't Justin Trudeau be our president? Oh, why can't we have healthcare like Canada? Oh, why can't we have gun laws like Canada? America is a hellhole and Canada is the great shining city on a hill that everyone aspires to. Every progressive wants to be like Canada. Meanwhile, in Canada, they hate themselves to a degree almost unbelievable. To the point where the horrible 150th anniversary was just supposed to be one big guilt trip about this or that native group that got screwed over when Cabot loaded up his boat and set sail for Newfoundland and screwed up an idyllic utopian continent. We are approaching the end point of all this. We are approaching the end point of all this because we are not talking about the great takeover in the 60s when the students started demanding this nonsense and even the most radical professor knew the truth. We are now dealing with stupid and uneducated students being taught by stupid and uneducated professors to loathe the civilizational inheritance that has enabled them to lead such self-indulgent lives predicated on the fact that everything they're the beneficiaries of is in fact evil and poisonous. We are now seriously approaching the end point of this psychosis, and the world that awaits will be far more evil, poisonous, violent, and destructive than anything we have ever known. That's not a very cheery note on which to end. What have I just said? It's the end of the world. How do I come up from that? Have we got like a P.G. Woodhouse special or anything coming up this weekend? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this weekend we'll pay one of PG Woodhouse singing Nested Time in Flatbush or something. We should have a cheerier note on which then. Anyway, Michael Covino, he's got a question about Robert Mueller, but he does say, I was given a Stein Club membership as a gift and I'm enjoying it immensely so far. Great stuff. Thanks. Michael, we love to hear from our gift members and I'm super delighted that you're enjoying your gift membership. If any club members would like to give a gift membership, it's not all doom and gloom. 90% of it is doom and gloom. 93-94%. But the other 6% is really buoyant opportunity. Optimistic stuff. And I thank you for joining us today. We will be back in a couple of hours with the latest thrilling installment of John Buchan and the 39 Steps. Don't worry, there's no Western civilization looked as if it was going over and sliding into the abyss when he was on the run, had Richard Hannay on the run in Scotland, and he survived. And we can survive, but we have to be honest about what we face. And we should not accept any longer the fatuous pap, the drip, drip, drip of this enervating, civilizational enervation. Anyway, that's my view. I felt a bit enervated myself today. I was terribly sleepy before I began. But your question, I was, a drowsy numbness pains my senses, though of hemlock I had drunk or emptied some dull opiate to the drains. 1 minute passed and Lethe woods had sunk. You know what that was? Maya Angelou? Dr. Seuss? Shel Silverstein? No, I'm not going to tell you. But that's the way I was feeling. You've perked me up no end. And we will pick up some of the additional questions maybe in the next video edition of Mark's Mailbox. But it is now just a little after 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That's 10 p.m. GMT, 3:30 a.m. in Delhi, and I think 11 a.m. in New Zealand. And that about does it for us. We will see you next time.